This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York. Today, author-nominated peer reviewers. Our panelists are Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University, Gabriel Rossman from UCLA, and Christina Sharp from the University of Washington. Our discussion was recorded on May 7th, 2019. So Nature recently reported on a study of peer review at the Swiss National Science Foundation, and it found that peer reviewers are four times more likely to give a grant applicant a positive score when they were chosen by the grant applicant. And the finding triggered calls to stop using peer review recommendations by the applicant. So the idea is that, I guess people, the charitable interpretation is that everybody understands who will see the true value in their project. And then the uncharitable one is everybody's asking friends who are in on the scam to, get some research money. Obviously, there are people who play this game. I remember in my career, I can remember at least two occasions where I met and got along with people who I would characterize as characters in a semi-professional setting. And then I got review requests from funding agencies for projects that I had like absolutely no expertise in. And like the right thing to do there is to say no. You shouldn't review things that you don't do, and you shouldn't interview, you know, stuff based on personal relations.
Yeah, because that's not how
it's not how it's supposed to work. Now, how it does work and how it's supposed to work are two different things, of course. But on the other hand, you might think, well, science relies on trust to work. And if we don't take authors or, you know, grant applicants' recommendations, how are we going to deal with that? Well, you know, are we going to have to – that puts a lot of burden on journals and the grant makers. So what do you think? Should we do it with applicant or author recommendations, or is there anything, any sort of practical changes that should be made, or is this a whole lot of nothing in your opinion?
I think did we touch on this, you know, at least like a little bit when we had Christine Percheski on? I can't remember if that was part of the recorded bit or if it was like a little bit of
what's
behind
that with
the
you,
scenes
though? What do you remember?
Chatter. I remember saying it took forever for a journal that will not be named to find reviewers. And while I understood that it probably would have totally cut down on the time if I had just given them a list of recommended reviewers, I just was committed. I just felt that was like antithetical to like the whole kind of idea of blind review. If I'm giving you the names of people and there's a likelihood that you're going to take them up, that it just seems totally wrong to me. Even though it does actually serve the purpose of helping to cut down on the amount of time that it takes to identify reviewers, and not just identify reviewers, but identify reviewers who would be likely to review the piece, you know, because even though in theory, they don't know whose piece this is. I mean, if you're in the same networks, you kind of understand, you kind of know whose work this is.
So wait, do you feel it's unethical?
I think it's unethical.
So I would draw a big distinction. So we're conflating two issues here, and sometimes in reality they go together, right? They can be correlated. But one issue is recommending reviewers, and another issue is reviewers who know who the author is. And, you know, it's a 2x2, right? I mean, there may be a certain weight on the diagonal, but it is a 2x2. So it's entirely possible to recommend a reviewer who has no idea that you wrote the paper. And, you know, I mean, so I'm an editor at Social Science, and so I get to, you know, nothing's blind to me. And all in the cover letters, I'll sometimes see that they request me as the editor to be assigned to it. But I have no idea who that person is. It's just that they looked on our, you know, masthead, saw who the reviewers are, and thought, oh, that guy does culture, so I'll request him, you know, or something like that. Or it could be that, you know, sometimes you'll know who somebody wrote a paper because, oh yeah, I remember that paper. I saw it at ASA, mm-hmm. but they may not have even known that you were in the room. Right. So, so I think it's possible to know who wrote a paper without being recommended. And it's also possible to recommend just because you think, oh yeah, you know, who would like this paper? Peter Behrman. I'm going to recommend Peter Behrman. So, you know, it's just, to a certain extent, this is kind of on the author to recommend people who you think would like the paper or at least are working in that area without them having been someone who, you know, is necessarily aware and definitely not someone who's given feedback on it, right? So, like, I consider it ethical to recommend a reviewer even if I know they were in the room when I presented the paper at ASA. But if they read a draft of the manuscript or something like that, I would never recommend that. Basically, if you can be in the if you could plausibly be in the acknowledgments, you should never be recommended.
Oh, so you think that there should be kind of like this arm's length kind of rule, like we have for, you know, for tenure and promotion letters.
Well, what's funny is sometimes tenure and promotion letters, you'll get a letter from somebody's advisor or something like that.
You're not supposed to have that. Well, at least not here, but.
Well, you know, UCLA, we're a little bit more, you know, so.
Well, doesn't that though, Gabriel, does?
Yeah, but I also think it's important for kind of some of the reasons Leslie was getting at is that, you know, there's two reasons reviewers could not like a paper. One is because the paper sucks and the other is because they just don't get it, right? And and it's actually really hard for managing editors, especially at a generalist journal, to figure out who are appropriate who are appropriate reviewers who would understand, you know, what a paper's getting at. Because a lot of times when, you know, you don't like a paper, it's not because the paper's bad in some abstract sense. It's just because it doesn't belong in your area. And, you know, so I've reviewed a couple papers that were about risk society, which to me seems like some, you know, environmental doomsday cult, not a, you know, an actual subfield of social science. But, you know, so that's an indication, not that those papers were bad necessarily, but that I'm a bad reviewer to be assigned those papers. And so, you know, and then conversely, you know, I've written stuff on, you know, categories or diffusion or whatever. And, you know, maybe it goes to a reviewer who's, you know, much more interested in hermeneutic approaches to culture. And of course, they're not going to like it. So, you know, and like I've had this experience where one of my grad students, like 10 years ago, wrote a paper on, you know, now former grad student. We don't have that long for our time to degree. You know, wrote a paper on local TV news coverage of crime. And it was a news paper, right? It was about, you know, media production. And the editor ended up assigning it to a bunch of criminologists. And so the criminologists are like, you know, why isn't there more on the demographic correlates of peak crime years and, you know, deterrence and incapacitation, stuff like that? And so, well, it's because it's a media paper. So, and so I think it's actually important to write a cover letter where you clearly say, A, this is the literature I'm speaking to, or better yet, these are the two literatures I'm speaking to, or the three literatures I'm speaking to. And then you give examples of people, but I think it's kind of a matter of trust between the author and the editor that you're not saying, you know who'd be perfect to review this paper? Joe Cohen and Leslie Hinkson, who I went to grad school with and are close friends. You know, but to say, you know, so I think I could ethically recommend Huggy Rao, you know, who I've met at like a conference or something like three times, but, you know, we're not especially close. I respect him a lot. But, you know, Huggy and I have had a total of probably 90 minutes of conversation. So I think I could ethically recommend Huggy review one of my papers, but I don't think I could ethically recommend that Joe recommend one of my papers. Although ironically, I once reviewed one of my co-authors' papers. So Oliver Schilke and I wrote a paper on, you know, the Oscars as a market information regime. And then I got assigned a paper to review on wine appellations as a market information regime. And I reviewed it and everything. And I had no idea until after I reviewed it that Oliver wrote it. So, you know, it just because, you know, this person is, you know, one of my closest collaborators in the discipline. He just hadn't had mentioned, he's just so goddamn productive that, you know, he writes more papers than he can tell all his co-authors about.
But like,
and So I don't know if you recommended me or not, but, you know, I was actually able to review it impartially because even though it was written by a close friend and collaborator, I didn't know that he wrote it.
But shouldn't we make something of the fact that, like, there is an identifiable bias in author nominated reviewers? Like, shouldn't editor put an asterisk beside an author nominated reviewer? And
well, I think there's two dimensions, right? Where if the bias is because they are working within your paradigm, I don't consider that a bias. Right. I consider that good editing to assign somebody like that. And if the author can help that, that's great. If the bias is because they favor you, you know, because you're friends and there's a conflict of interest, then that is a problem.
So then how can we figure out how to disentangle that? I mean, how, like, as an editor, how do you say, you know what, I want this to be as objective a process as possible. I also want it to be as efficient a process as possible, right? How do I figure out how to use, you know, these recommendations in such a way that, you know, I'm not kind of like tipping the scales in favor of people who actually use the reviewer recommendation as a way to just get, you know, whatever, get their social network involved to help ensure their publication.
Yeah, I actually have experience with that because we have a weird system at Social Science where we pretty much only, I mean, not only, but 80% of the time we assign reviewers from our reviewer pool. So unless somebody's named somebody who happens to be in our reviewer pool, which is fairly small, it's like 50 people, then I don't go with their recommendations. But, you know, that might be a good question for, say, Omar.
I think, too, that there's other ways that people know that it's someone's paper. So, like, with my estrangement research, there aren't many of us who do it. So, like, I don't even have to... Like, everyone's going to, I mean, for the most part, a lot of people might guess that it's my paper or guess that I might be reviewing a paper if they're writing about estrangement. So even without the request, there's still like ways that people might know that you have a paper or you might guess who your reviewer is that I don't think that editors can ever mitigate completely.
Well, I think that's true, but that's always a probabilistic guess, right? So I once got a nasty email from somebody who was like, you know, oh, you're a fucking snob because you went to Princeton and now you're at UCLA and you don't realize you just lucked out in life and how dare you give my paper a bad review? And I'm like, I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about. I was not your reviewer. And then I ended up having a pleasant conversation with the person and basically told them he needs to chill the fuck out and, you know, not try and pick fights with people. And, you know, as it happens, I'm actually completely aware that, you know, I have a much better career than in the counterfactual where I started grad school in 2004 and went on the market in 2010. You know, so, I mean, you can have guesses, but you don't actually know, right? And it may be that, partly it depends on how small the field is, right? But, like, if somebody reviews a manuscript on the Oscars, they might think, oh, that's probably Rossman's paper because he's written two papers on the Oscars. But, you know, there's actually half a dozen people who've published sociology articles on the Oscars. So how do you know it's me and not Olaf Sorensen or somebody?
I think by counting the number of times you or Sorensen are cited within that piece. That's
Well, that's true. But I also think I actually think it's important to not do the author cite removed thing because I think that actually makes it more obvious.
No, me too. So do I.
Yeah. Like if it says like in an analysis of 19,853, films from 1927 to 2005, you know, where status, you know, where the credit centrality was used as a metric, you know, author removed. It's like, well, you know, that's either me, Nicole Esparza, or Phil Bonisich.
Yeah, you're like,
right?
Come
whereas
on,
if the citation's in there, you know, it could just be that it's Olaf Sorensen and he likes our paper.
You've been listening to The Annex, an academic sociology podcast. You can visit our show site at sociocast.org/annex. We are on Twitter at @SociAnnex and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Lisseth Moreno. Music by Lena Orsa. I'm Joseph Cohen. Thank you for listening.